This is Brother Colin Badger's fourth class on the overall theme of exhortations for wisdom taken from the book of Proverbs. The title of his fourth class is The Fool, the Simple, and the Sluggard.
Good morning, brothers and sisters.
Good morning.
As we continue in our study thematically of the book of Proverbs, today we'd like to turn our attention to three key words that travel all through the book of Proverbs. The three words or phrases being the fool, the simple, and the sluggard. Now that may seem to be a little negative, but there's a strong repetition. And we were talking about repetition, if you remember, in our first class, that repetition of words or phrases in any book of the Bible are often a key to meaning, to primary message, and sometimes repetition of key phrases, like these three here, can be sometimes a clue to structure. As we look across the book of Proverbs for the term fool, the simple, and the sluggard, there is a very definite concentration of all three of those in just about all the sections of the book of Proverbs. One could, as we did previously with a graph, show where there is some clustering or concentration more than in other locations. But in this particular theme this morning, those three travel all through the book of Proverbs fairly evenly, and obviously their frequency, the fool, the simple, and the sluggard, are telling us that a very key message in the book of Proverbs relates to alerting those who would be wise and those who would walk in God's ways to watch out for the characteristics and the gullibility of the fool, as distinct from and yet clearly related to the weaknesses of the simple, whatever the simple is or whoever they are. And then the book of Proverbs, again, by its frequent repetition to the word sluggard, is clearly telling those who are to be kings in training, those who would be kings, in fact, for ourselves in the future as kings and priests, as David was passing on this wisdom to Solomon, his son, as Solomon was passing it on in turn to his generation, or as King Lemuel or King Hezekiah was passing on the collective proverbial pieces of wisdom to their generation, all of them are concerned about alerting their sons and daughters to the role of the fool, the gullibility of being the simple, and the hazards of being the sluggard. Let's look at our terms. First of all, the term fool, and we're going to look at some specific passages which will help us with this. Let's just look at these three operative terms to start with. And by the way, we will come back to this list. So if you're trying to write down or check in a concordance later, which is a good idea, of course, this will be on the screen more than once during the session. When the book of Proverbs uses the word fool, and it's used this particular term primarily in the book of Proverbs and Ecclesiastes, the lexicon tells us that the term used in Proverbs and Ecclesiastes primarily means to be dull or to be obstinate. To be dull or to be obstinate. Now, there's more than one Hebrew word for fool. You recall Abigail's husband, whose name was? Because he was a? Right. Nabal was a fool. And we can see that in the margin, and it spells that out very clearly in Samuel. A case that in point, there's more than one word for fool or foolish or foolishness. But it's worthy of note that the word that we're focusing on, especially in the book of Proverbs, is primarily, not exclusively, found in Proverbs and Ecclesiastes. Now, there's a common denominator. They are part of the books of wisdom, as the Jews called them. And finding its primary frequency in Proverbs and Ecclesiastes, we should note, of course, both of those are composed by Solomon. So there is, in fact, and this is another subject in itself, a rather interesting link in more than one way between the book of Ecclesiastes and the book of Proverbs. In many ways, the problem in the book of Ecclesiastes, the vanity of life under the sun as it is lived by the sons of men, and what seems to be no purpose and no true eternal satisfaction, a major theme running through Ecclesiastes, is actually left hand, right hand with the book of Proverbs, which almost immediately talks about wisdom being able to give life. And that there is meaning in that sense. And there is purpose that can be found under the sun, but it's not given by the activities under the sun. It takes us something beyond or somewhere or to someone beyond just the activities of men who labor under the sun. That common phrase in Ecclesiastes. So another subject, but this relationship of fool with its primary usage in Proverbs and Ecclesiastes is only one tiny thread that brings those two books, as a matter of fact, together, left hand, right hand. So then, dull or obstinate? Now think of how this relates to ourselves. Because at times, in our need to cultivate, through God's help, divine wisdom in our decisions, wisdom as we raise our children, wisdom as the brothers labor over pastoral issues in the ecclesia, wisdom in terms of dealing with our marriages, wisdom in terms of dealing with our daily life in the office, do's and don'ts, making decisions between clean and unclean, like yesterday's reference, making decisions between what's good and what's bad, we clearly can so easily be dull and obstinate. Dull, that's not meant to be simply a pejorative slight. But did not Jesus talk about those who were dull of hearing? Can we not also be guilty of being dull of hearing? Obstinate, isn't stubbornness germane to human nature? Are we not all stubborn at times? Do we not all at times dig in our heels in terms of tensions with our spouse, tensions in our family, but also in conflict with the Father's will? Are we not often very obstinate? Second term, traveling through this theme this morning, the term simple or the simple ones. It means, particularly from the Hebrew, to be gullible or to be deceived. Are we not also, like Eve and Adam in the garden, very, very susceptible to deceiving suggestions, to half-truths, sometimes to outright lies? Are we not easily deceived by the world's influence? And doesn't sin itself in our own nature make us very inclined, prone, susceptible to deceiving influences? Do we not have a rather false court often in our minds where we clearly and easily excuse ourselves from guilt? Do we not easily rationalize? Are we not often deceiving ourselves, let alone other people? So the gullibility, the susceptibility to deception, is encased in the idea of the word simple as it travels through Proverbs. Finally, the third term in this kind of threefold theme is the warning to the readers who would be kings in training to not be sluggards. Sluggards. Now, there's more than one kind of sluggard. There's a sluggard in the ecclesia. There's a sluggard in the home. There's a sluggard in the workplace. And there's a general lifestyle that can make us sluggish as a person. So, quite obviously, more than perhaps the other two, In Proverbs, the word used for sluggard means inaction, lack of effort, or lack of intent. And we all need that exhortation to raise ourselves sometimes from indolence, from laziness, in the ecclesia, in the home, in our daily lives, in our application to divine things. We really need often to take the exhortation from the apostle that to be zealously affected in a good thing is important. The exhortation to be diligent and vigorous in our discipleship travels right from Old into New Testament. So there's our key set of terms. Let's explore them in Proverbs. Would you turn to Proverbs 26? Let's turn to Proverbs chapter 26 and let's get some sense of how this exhortation, first of the three, term number one, exhortation for wisdom, warnings against playing the fool. I'm going to use the RSV here for these two verses. That's verse 7 and verse 9 of Proverbs 26. Watch what this says from the RSV. We might not have seen quite this sense from a reading of the King James, and that is my own primary Bible, so I would confess at times I haven't always appreciated the force of some of these expressions without the help of some other assistance. Here we are, Proverbs 26 then, and let's look at verse 7 and then verse 9. Watch what it says about the fool in terms of Proverbs. This is interesting. In terms of Proverbs and the fool. Like a lame man's legs, which hang useless, is a proverb in the mouth of fools. Now you got to stop and think about that, don't you, for a moment. Like a lame man's legs, which hang useless, is a proverb in the mouth of fools. A lame man's legs do not serve him. A lame man's legs do not support him. Think of someone like Mephibosheth, for example. We just read about him not long ago in the readings in Samuel. He described himself as a dead dog. He was a cripple. Today, appropriately, we'd say physically challenged, follically challenged. It's just not there. It just isn't functioning. Hasn't for a long time, as a matter of fact. So there's a uselessness. Now, put a proverb in the mouth of a fool? No, it's useless. Exhortation, don't be a fool. Exhortation, listen to the proverb. This is a neat passage because not only is it just defining or giving an example of what a fool is in Proverbs, it's in fact relating a fool to a proverb and saying that there's a real problem when you're trying to teach wisdom to a fool. So many times, the proverb in the mouth of the fool is like a lame man's legs. It is not accepted. It becomes useless. It may be taken in a sense, but it doesn't support. It doesn't help the individual to get up and walk and to conduct oneself in a way that shows some change or some influence from the proverb. Look at the other half. Come to verse 9, right here. Like a thorn that goes into the hand of a drunk is a proverb in the mouth of fools. What's that saying? Well, a man that's deeply inebriated, a woman that's drunk, put a thorn in their hands when they're deeply drunk, and sure, they will perhaps feel it up to some extent, but the intoxication, the inebriation, has taken over and dulled the pain. There may be some sense of the pain, but drive a thorn in the hand of a drunk, and you will not get the same effect as if he was sober, obviously. So what's that saying? Try to put a proverb in the mouth of a fool, and it will not have its effect. It might have some, but not much. It will not obviously go to its target. So the fool is likened here in two different metaphors, graphically typical of human nature. Human nature tends to be lame. Yes? We do tend to be lame. And in the ministry, the Lord Jesus Christ often illustrated his work as the great healer, the healer of sin and all of its problems, by healing lame. And Isaiah, in that well-known passage that talks about a rose shall bloom in a lonely place, as we sang it last night, says that the lame will leap like an unharmed deer. The lame, said Jesus, have now been able to walk. Go back and tell John the Baptist that. It's a sign of my messiahship. The great physician is here. The lame, that's human nature. Typically, besides the deaf and the blind and the leprous, all appropriate figures of our condition. So, first of all, human beings naturally are rather lame and in need of being helped to walk. Secondly, human beings are quite naturally intoxicated with themselves. They are often filled with themselves. They're often not able to register very well. And if you think of the apocalypse, the woman with the cup has intoxicated the nations of the world. She has a deadly brew, and they have become inebriated. They've lost their senses. They no longer have sense. They're not responding at all. So that kind of language, those two metaphors, are telling us how difficult it is for Proverbs to sink into human nature. We tend to be lame, and we tend to be intoxicated with our own selves and our own needs and our own wants. Now, we come back to something we covered in our first class, that a proverb, literally in the Hebrew, is a comparison. See the two comparisons. Obviously, the lame man and the drunkard are illustrations of our natural condition and our need to change and be responsive to the Proverbs, but also to all of God's counsel, of course, to God's wisdom. That poses a problem. We ought to be alert to the fact that we are not by nature good learners of divine things. We need repetition. We need assistance. Now, we're not going to go to these passages, but you might want to write them down, because now I'm just going to bring in a picture here from the Master. It's appropriate at this junction. And that's this. Listen to Jesus talking about fools. Who's he talking to, and what's the punch? Because he's talking proverbial. He's talking very much like the book of Proverbs, like King Solomon before him. Jesus said this at the end of the ministry. Notice where it is. Matthew 23, we're under the shadow of the Olivet prophecy. Matthew 23, verse 19. Ye fools and blind, for whether is greater, the gift or the altar that sanctifies the gift? These were leaders, contextually, people who should have known better. You are fools, he says. You are fools. You are dull. You are obstinate. You do not get it. And this now, such powerful, punching language, of course, from the Master, comes at the end of the three-year ministry. There's a step up in the pulse. There's a stronger tempo in his words. There's a much more direct hit here. It's a crying appeal to break through the armor. Let's go on with just a similar context. Luke 24, verse 25, about the same time in the ministry, Luke's rendition is, then he said unto them, watch this, O fools, and slow of heart to believe. See the obstinacy coming through, the dullness coming through, as the meaning of the Hebrew word in the Old Testament in Proverbs is. He said unto them, fools and slow of heart to believe all that the prophets have spoken. The problem of our foolishness, as illustrated in Matthew 23:19, not trying to distance ourselves too much from those leaders, because they had some problems that we have, no doubt. They're obviously there as an illustration, the leaders of Israel, and as a warning to our own susceptibility to be like them. So they were fools and blind. Might not we be? He said to them, "You are fools and slow of heart. Are not we also slow of heart?" Didn't Jesus even say to the 12 more than once, "O fools and slow of heart, are you still without understanding?" Or similar types of phrases when he had given them several signs and they still didn't understand the meaning of the loaves. Did he not rebuke them finally at that point? Similar kind of language, though not word for word. What about Paul? Romans chapter 1, our third example here, just providing a New Testament forward to it. Romans 1, verse 22, professing themselves to be wise. Do you hear the echo to the Garden of Eden? The desire to make one wise, the temptation to be wise, the profession, he says, of many in Romans 1, is that they professed themselves to be wise, but they became fools. Context of Romans 1, the universality of sin as it dominates both Jew and Gentile. Romans 1 is making that very clear. All have sinned. His climatic statement there in the early chapters of Romans. All have sinned and come short of the glory of God. All have sinned. There is not one, Paul's climax, as he has built it from chapter 1. Then this exhortation about fools, and then the simple, and then the sluggard, is a theme that is really outside the boundaries of Proverbs itself. We're just getting a survey of the landscape from Proverbs and just a little beyond. Would you come back now to Proverbs? Chapter 12, if you have it available. Proverbs chapter 12. How this is relevant to Jesus' words that we just quickly surveyed in Matthew and in Luke when he talked about, "O fools and slow of heart, O fools, the blind, leaders of the blind." Because in Proverbs chapter 12, verse 15, the dull and the obstinate, the fool, is highlighted this way. "The way of a fool is right in his own eyes, but he that hearkeneth unto counsel is wise." Now, what is that saying? We can very quickly skate over it, Canadian expression. We can very easily skate over it and not stop to think about the meaning. The way of a fool is right in his own eyes, but he that hearkens unto counsel is wise. What's the impediment? What's the trip up? He's telling us that quite often, one of the problems of the fool, which we all are at times, is a sense of confidence that what we are thinking and what we are saying and what we are doing is right in our own eyes. We are our own judge. We are both the prosecutor and we are also the acquitter. We so easily dismiss ourselves in the courts of our own minds. We often render a not guilty verdict to ourselves. So often, what we say and do, no matter how wrong at times it has been, we often say to ourselves, "I had some justification. I was right in what I said or did. Ah, yes, there may have been some fault there, but in the overall, he had it coming. In the overall, she needed to hear it. In the overall, the kids needed it." Well, at times they do need it, whatever that is. But many times when we haven't done it right, or we've been guilty of speaking too quickly or misjudging, it's because we are right in our own eyes. So the proverb is exhorting us that we can be fools. And one of the impediments is the fact that being right in our own eyes, self-confidence is often the trip-up that makes us a fool, as opposed to hearkening to the counsel of the wise. Just slip over to Proverbs 18. in verse 2. Still dealing with the fool. A fool, verse 2, and I'm going to quote this now from the NIV. A fool finds no pleasure in understanding, but delights. Now this hurts. But delights in airing his own opinions. Are we guilty of that so often? A fool finds no pleasure in understanding. What's the impediment to understanding here? What's the roadblock? What's the common thorny problem that stands in the way according to God's own analysis? God is saying, brothers and sisters, kings in training, David is saying to Solomon, Hezekiah is saying it as well, to those who would be kings, a fool finds no pleasure in understanding, but has tremendous delight in airing his own opinion. Our own opinions, again, coming back again to the self-centered aspect of the fool, so often our own opinions are our pride and joy. Our own opinions, quotes, are often the impediment that stands in the way to us having deeper understanding. It may not be that we're guilty at all times of having no pleasure in understanding, but perhaps it's not a deep understanding. Perhaps the understanding could be broadened, it could be plummeted a little further. Perhaps our understanding could be refined, improved, deepened, quite simply. What stands in the way of its growth? Often our own opinions. What is that saying practically? The need to seek counsel from others besides ourselves. Because it is, in fact, Proverbs that says, in a multitude of counselors, there is strength or there is wisdom. In a multitude of counselors, Proverbs says elsewhere, there is wisdom or there is strength. Furthermore, and finally, of course, God's Word itself is the ultimate counselor, and quite often our own opinions are expressed before we have gone back to thus saith the Lord, as opposed to thus saith Colin. How important that is. Our own opinion must be humbled before his counsel. It is not our opinion, it's not what I think, it's thus saith the Lord. Jesus put his finger on that as well to the fools of his own day. You do err, not knowing the scriptures, nor the power of God, he said. That was to be ultimately their appeal, their source of authority. So now that's just a little touch on the word fool. You'll find it elsewhere in your own study, in your own reading. It's helpful sometimes just to have a colored pencil and just shade some of the references with the help of a concordance to these three terms, just to highlight them. Now, what about that simple? The gullible and the deceived. Let's have some concrete examples of this. Proverbs chapter 7. This is one of the most graphic, most powerful pictures in all the book of Proverbs about something that's a common problem. The lead-in, Proverbs chapter 7, verse 5. That they may keep thee, that's the counsel of wisdom and the Proverbs of God, looking at verse 3 and 4. That they may keep thee from the strange woman, from the stranger which flattereth with her lips, with her words. Verse 5. Verse 6, for at the window of my house I looked through my casement. Here's our term, second term. Verse 7. And looking through his casement, I beheld among the simple ones, the gullible. I discerned among the youths, a young man, void of understanding, passing through the street near her corner. Who's her? And he went the way to her house, in the twilight, in the evening, in the black and dark night. And behold, there met him a woman with the attire of a harlot and subtle of heart. She is loud and stubborn, her feet abide not in her house. Now she is without, now in the streets, and lieth in wait at every corner. So, verse 13, she caught him. That's the simple one, brothers and sisters, the youth. She caught him and kissed him, and with an impudent face said unto him, I have peace offerings with me this day, have I paid my vows. Therefore came I forth to meet thee, diligently to seek thy face, young man. I have found thee, I have decked my bed with coverings of tapestry, with carved works, with fine linen of Egypt. I've perfumed my bed with myrrh, aloes, and cinnamon. Come, let us take our fill of love until the morning. Let us solace or comfort ourselves with loves. Verse 19, for the good man is not at home. He is gone on a long journey. He hath taken a bag of money with him and will come home at the day appointed. She's got it marked on the calendar. Verse 21, with her much fair speech, she caused him to yield. With the flattering of her lips, she forced him. He goeth after her straightway, as an ox goeth to the slaughter, or as a fool to the correction of the stocks, till a dark strike through his liver, as a bird hasteth to the snare, and knoweth not that it is for his life. Hearken unto me now, therefore, O ye children. Attend to the words of my mouth. Let not thine heart decline to her ways. Go not astray in her paths. Verse 27, her house is the way to hell, going down to the chambers of death. Have we read that before? Could you get it more graphic? Could it be more pointed? Do you recall the other day, the two women, the metaphor of Miss Wisdom versus Miss Folly, and how they both have their two sets of appeal, and they have their methods, and we highlighted that Miss Folly especially appeals to carnal instincts. And you see here that the simple ones, those are the key terms that we're looking at here, the simple ones relating to this gullible man, and it could be a gullible woman just as much. Verse 7, these, the simple ones, are those defined as youths, but could obviously be just as applicable to older individuals, are fools, true. But they're simple in the sense that they are gullible and able to be persuaded. And the approach is through the channels of the senses. The good man's gone. I know when he's coming back. Come, let's spend the night together. Is that a modern parable? It's a very modern parable. The seductiveness of another party, the wooing to indulge, the desire to appeal to the senses is clearly a modern problem. With her much fair speech, hear that, with her much fair speech, she caused him to yield. With the flattering of her lips, she forced him. Much fair speech. Is there a Bible echo here to someone else or something else? Who else is described as being able to influence through much fair speech? Absalom. The serpent, true enough, typical of all Absaloms. And certainly with the readings, as Brother John is highlighting here, Absalom fawning himself for months, weeks, longer than that, displaying himself at the gate and being the judge, and with his much fair speech, serpent-like as he was, he influenced and tilted the sway of the nation against David. Much fair speech is clearly a serpentile metaphor in Scripture, a modern parable. Well, we can think of examples, can't we? We can think of Joseph being challenged, of course, while he was in Pharaoh or Potiphar's realm. We can look at that example tangibly as she had a good man of the house, as it were. She had a husband, no problem. He's not around, Joseph. Let's indulge. Let's let the flesh have a fling. Joseph's response, of course, is absolutely ideal. Hard as it was to flee the temptation and to resist the approach. But there's no doubt that that woman, similar to the one in Proverbs 7, had a very similar set of tools. She had, no doubt, the power of speech. And being in Egypt, think of that, here in this context, it's appropriate as a parallel. I have decked my bed with coverings of tapestry, says this woman, verse 16, with carved works with the fine linens of Egypt. Absolutely appropriate as a parallel to the Joseph challenge. But brothers and sisters, in the offices and in the places where we work today, having a ring on your finger means nothing. In some cases, it's almost a draw. In some cases, there are individuals who almost prefer to make the advances with someone who does wear a ring on their finger. In most cases, no matter whether married or unmarried, that clear appeal that's being described in the context of Proverbs 7 is ever so modern, is it not? And do we not have constantly, as we have had in the past, it's not just a modern problem, some tragic results of the flirtations accepted by another party and giving in slow steps, working in the office till 8 and only the secretaries there in the next room. Or constantly on business trips where the team consists of 2 or 3 good-looking individuals who, after the business is done for the day, go back to the restaurant with us. And then what? We're all assigned rooms in the hotel? Don't think that hasn't happened. I'm sure you know it has. We are all susceptible. At high school, in a cafeteria, having taught for about 32 years, if I was to show you the statistics, even from back home in a small area like Brantford, which is not big Toronto, where I originally came from, and you look at teenage pregnancies, if you take a look at the stats, where they have done polls with teenagers in high school and asked them how many of them have already become sexually active at the high school age, let alone the university age, the results now are staggering. Those even in the upper grades of junior school, that is to say from grade 6 and up, are now filling out those kind of inquiries from the educators signaling they are already sexually active. Grade 6 and above. Key areas of start. Brothers and sisters, we live in an age that is perverse, it is tempting, and the videos and the TVs and the magazines and the newspapers and the CDs, all of that helped to put into our minds and the minds of our children the constant suggestion that free sex is okay. Indulgence just once is worth the experiment. That you need to know it and experience it. You need to taste it. You need to have it before you can be sure. What are we doing, brothers and sisters, quite frankly, not to be the fools as parents? And not to be the simple ones as parents, nor to let our children be the simple ones. Do they all have a TV in their own room? And do you go to bed at night with those TVs on? Do they all have access to the internet? And are you aware how easily the pop-ups that are pornographic can easily appear on the screen? The educators back home doing all kinds of things in the schools to have these shepherding programs to filter that stuff out. But it's almost impossible to filter all that out. There was a survey done at four Bible schools two summers ago, our Bible schools, where the young people's classes, by permission of the committees, were asked to fill out a response form that would be held in confidence. They could either do it at the school or they could go on the internet. It was primarily through the internet channel. Password was provided to the kids, Christadelphian kids. About, I don't know, close to 20 or 30 questions were posed, give or take. Have you ever had free sex? Have you ever involved yourself in drugs? When our brethren looked at the results at the end of that summer, and people were still ticking in on the keyboard well into October and November, I can tell you, brothers and sisters, from about four Bible schools, a good number of our youth said, yes, we've had sex. Yes, we've overdrank. Yes, we've indulged in drugs. And the parents don't know it. If you think that's a problem just in the world, what we conducted in Southern Ontario, and to some extent with the help of at least four other Bible schools, is staggering. It is there, and it is a problem. And we've got to make sure we do not have the blinders on. It's not just our kids, of course, it's us as well. We need to sharpen our awareness of what's happening in our homes. What about the movies we're letting them watch? What about the monitoring of a computer? Where is the computer kept? In private bedrooms or out in the living room where it can be watched? Does everyone have access? And does everyone go to sleep at different times? And then who knows what's being watched? How do you control the pop-ups? How do you control the suggestions that can woo you into seductive, interactive sites? I'm being blunt, but it's no blunter than Proverbs chapter 7. Brothers and sisters, I think Proverbs chapter 7 is telling all of us that we can be fools in more than one way. As parents, likewise our children. We can be gullible and easily deceived as brothers and sisters and as parents in more than one way. And we've got the responsibility to get up and do something, which takes us to this last one. For ourselves in discipleship, and knowing the challenges of the pressures around us to indulge ourselves, knowing the temptations that beset our children, and the specific reference that I've just given you by way of example from what we gained only a couple of summers ago in that survey or those surveys, we have reasons to act, to help our children in Sunday school, in CYC, but first of all, in our homes. Is the Bible being read? And is it being, moreover, understood? And finally, are we engendering a love for that word? Whether it's the regular reading plan or whatever plan we may think is best for our children and our families, when the dishes are over or before they're done or before the children leave for school in the morning, you and I, before we go out in that world, or at the end of the day, having come back from that world, need to gather around that word with our children and help them to have the awareness that they need to not be gullible, to not be the simple ones of the world, to be able, with God's help, to resist those kind of temptations. And we ourselves need to be washed in that word just as much and have its fortifying help. A Bible on the desk in the office, a Bible in our locker, taking it to the cafeteria, having it at our side, making sure we've got some clear declaration to ourselves and those who know us that we are connected to that word and we seek its wisdom. Go to the ant, says Proverbs, thou sluggard. Consider her ways and be wise. Well, that language, by the way, is very similar to consulting the example of God's creatures. In wisdom, he's made them all. Psalm 104, verse 24 to 5. Clearly, the example of the ant as one from nature is showing us that nature is not only as God has brought it about for our pleasure. Nature can also be used for instruction in divine principles. Consider the ant. Consider his diligence as a parent. His diligence as an example for disciples. Proverbs chapter 6, still, verse 7 and 8. having no guide, brothers and sisters, this little ant, and having no overseer, or even a ruler, breathing down on the little ant, the ant is not a sluggard. The ant, without having a ruler or someone standing there with a stick or a timer, the ant provides her meat in the summer before it gets cold. And she gathers her food in the harvest. That's like the parable of Matthew 24, where the good man goes on a journey and he entrusts his servants with a deposit. What will they do with the deposit in the absence of the ruler or the overseer? The language of that parable, proverb, of Matthew 24 just might be drawing on this very kind of context in Proverbs. In the absence of Christ, where he's not standing before us, and he's not on his throne visibly in the room, in our house, in the halls of the school, in the office, in the kitchen, in the living room or family room, are we providing meat like the ant in the summer, knowing that winter will soon come, and gathering food in the harvest when there is grain to be had? Are we diligent in gleaning and harvesting the rich supply of God's spiritual wisdom in this word, and benefiting as we are this week from the strength of fellowship? Are we getting our young people to Bible class? Are we getting them out to CYC? Are we just dropping them off? Are we getting them out to Sunday school and being there with them as an example, or just dropping them off? And if we're in isolation, what have we done to make sure that they have isolation Sunday school? Whatever is necessary to make sure the homework of the school and so on is not the only input of the day or of the week. Are we sluggards at times? Not only as disciples among ourselves in the ecclesia, but might we be sluggards in dealing with our children and the instruction of the young, the constant theme that runs through Proverbs? Proverbs chapter 6 continues, verse 9 and 10 and 11. You just might want to have that out as we come to the end here this morning. I think it's a sober, sober inventory for all of us. How long, brothers and sisters, and let's apply it to ourselves. Let's hold up the mirror of Proverbs. Because, pause for a minute, who's this author? Or who's the compiler? It's none other than the wisest man of the world at the time, Solomon. Was he susceptible? Did he ever play the fool, Solomon? Was he ever, in a sense, gullible? Was he ever sluggish? He was. The wisest man, endowed, of course, with that gift from God, Solomon himself, married multiple wives. He married, moreover, wives that drew his heart away. He married girls in the world. He did. And it was the girls in the world, or we could flip it, if he had been the queen, the guys in the world, either way, that drew the wisest man's heart away to carnal things, that convinced him that the ways of Egypt and the gods and goddesses that they worshipped was all right to have set up in Israel. And in the end, he gathered chariots to himself, which the king of Israel was not to do. And he accumulated great wealth, which was warned against for the kings of Israel, even in Deuteronomy, before they had kings. If a Solomon could trip up, what of David? Did David ever play the fool? Well, he certainly did more than once. He drooled like a madman by the gates of Gath. He also was susceptible when the armies were doing their thing on the field of battle. One day, on the house, he saw a woman, another man's, and then tried to cover it up, and in a sense became the accomplice of murder. If David, apart from Solomon, could fall prey by being perhaps not with the armies, a little sluggish perhaps at that time, if he could be gullible, susceptible, open to appeal, if he could follow his eyes and the carnal impulses that rang through him that night when he saw what he did, if he could fall prey to his own carnal instincts, the Lord's anointed, David, who slew the giant on that time, could not take on the giant of his own ego and his own sexual passions. Then, brothers and sisters, what are we doing letting our kids seeing what they're seeing, going to the movies they're going to, reading the smut that sometimes they read, and being a teacher, I sure recall it, and a father of four children now in their 20s or 30s, it's absolutely common to all of us as a challenge. How long will we sleep, O sluggard? When wilt thou arise out of thy sleep? Get out of the dormancy. Wake up, he's saying to us, as parents and as disciples. Yet, a little sleep, a little slumber, a little folding of the hands to sleep, so shall thy poverty come as one that traveleth, and thy want as an armed man. The theme of the fool, the theme of the simple, and the theme of the sluggard, you see, belong together. Brothers and sisters, let's clean our glasses and let's wake up to the need to take, in some cases, drastic measures in our own home, and sometimes, definitely, drastic measures for ourselves, and keep ourselves like a Joseph and flee youthful lusts, which are common as a weakness to all of us, no matter how old we are. And let us be diligent and get out of the hammock and do something positive to help stay the tide that is besetting us.